All right, well, I invite you to 2 Kings chapter 17 this morning. 2 Kings chapter 17. We've been looking at a study of the kings, trying to do it side by side, you know, as much on a historical timeline as we can. The Jewish historians were not as chronological as our mindset would be. They tended to follow one train of thought all the way to the end and then back up and get the next one. And so that often they would finish out, you know, 10, 20, 30, sometimes 40 years of one king and then back up that far to get, you know, the other kingdom. But in 2 Kings chapter 17, we have reached the end of the line for the northern kingdom of Israel. Hoshea was the king here, and Israel had already started paying tribute money. They were in servitude to Assyria, but in the time of Hoshea, the captivity of the northern tribes was complete. And so then, beginning in verses 7 on down in chapter 17, we have God's summary of Israel's history. We see their decisions. They chose idolatry. God sent them messengers. They chose to harden their heart. They went so far as human sacrifice and divination, which is, you know, demonic, satanic ritual and so forth. And so then ultimately that brings us to the judgment of God in chapter 17, verse number 18. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah only. So we get to this point where God has said, all right, I've given you as many chances as I'm going to. Now you're at a time of judgment. So some look at this and go, how could God be so cruel without rewinding? I mean, we've been going through this, you know, along and along, but at this point, how many prophets had been sent by God to them? Well, I mean, the ones that we know by name would be Elijah and Elisha. You also have Jonah and Hosea and Micah and some prophets like that. By the time we get down to this point, you also have Isaiah. And so there's been, you know, a half a dozen or more that we know of, plus others that we don't, you know, necessarily know by name. So has God just been harsh and unkind, or has God been long-suffering with Israel? Very much so long-suffering. God has testified to them over and over and over again. And so God finally said, all right, you're out of chances. This is it. And Israel is going into captivity. All right, so when we talk about the Assyria's practices here in verse number 24 of chapter 17, we kind of see a summary of the Assyrian Empire and their practices having conquered a nation or a people. Verse 24, the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Cuthah and from Ava and from Hamath and from Sepharvaim. So these are foreign places that they've already conquered, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. So we've already seen earlier that when he captured Hoshea, he deported them. Now we have in verses 24 and following a repopulation. So they took the inhabitants of Samaria and carried a large number of them away. And then they brought others back in. Now, depending on your particular situation and where you live, you know, if somebody came in and took half of your neighborhood and moved them out, you might be sad or you might be happy. But, you know, you never know, all right, who's going to be placed back in that house next to you or across the street. Could be worse, right? And that's kind of what's happening. People got carried out. Others were brought back in. Property was distributed and so forth. Yes, I am well aware that John Stevens is voting me out of the neighborhood. So, okay. Well, he didn't want to lose Trisha and the kids. That's really what he means there. So, but you know, this is what's going on, and they would mix and match. That was a way of preventing rebellion. Okay, because if they were allowed to stay in their own land, in their familiar territory with their familiar people and so forth, it was much easier for them to coordinate and maybe organize a rebellion or resistance. But once they, when they transplanted people, they were out of their element, They didn't know the area. They didn't have the same resources. And quite honestly, there's probably a language barrier there too, right? And so all of those things helped to prevent rebellion. But that was the practice of the Assyrians. Now, look with me in verse 25 and following. And it was so at the beginning of their dwelling there that they feared not the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which slew some of them. That's interesting. Because if you read the rest of the chapter, they didn't exactly fear the Lord in the way that we would think of it, in the sense of serving God alone and serving Him according to what He had revealed in the law of Moses and so forth. But it's very interesting. Even though God allowed Assyria to carry away Israel captive and to bring in other nations and other captives to repopulate that area of northern Israel, God was still making it very clear, this is my land, these are my people. God sent lions among them, which slew some of them. Verse 26, wherefore they spake to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations which thou hast removed and placed in the cities of Samaria know not the manner of the God of the land. Therefore he has sent lions among them, and behold, they slay them, because they know not the manner of the God of the land. Interesting. The heathen people recognize what was going on, right? And it almost reminds me of Jonah, right? Where the heathen people, quote unquote, recognized what was going on, you know, before Jonah did. So verse 27, the king of Assyria commanded, saying, carry thither one of the priests whom you brought from thence, and let him go and dwell there and teach them the manner of the God of the land. Then one of the priests whom they'd carried from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. Howbeit, every nation made gods of their own and put them in the houses of the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in their cities wherein they dwelt. Verse 30, the men of Babylon made Sukkoth-Benoth, the men of Cuth made Nergal, and the men of Hamath made Ashima, and the Avites made Nibhaz and Tartak, and the Sepharvites burnt their children in the fire to Adrammelech and Anammelech, the gods of Sepharvim. So are they truly fearing the Lord in its purest sense? No. So what they did was simply they added the God of heaven to their collection, if I could say it that way. For some nations, that would be adding to the shelf of gods. But they at least learned who God was to a certain extent, and so they would offer sacrifices to the God of heaven along with all of these other names I don't want to try to pronounce again, okay? But all of these other false gods, they worshiped them, and as you see, it was extreme. They made, in certain cases, they burnt their children in the fire, still the human sacrifice and the vile practices that are connected with this idolatrous worship. Verse 32, they feared the Lord and made themselves of the lowest of them, priests of the high places, which sacrificed for them in the high places. Verse 33, they feared the Lord and served their own gods after the manner of the nations whom they carried away thence. Unto this day they do after the former manners. They fear not the Lord, neither do they after the statutes, ordinances, or the law and commandments which the Lord commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. It's kind of interesting to me, the contrast. They feared the Lord and they served these other gods. And then we get down to verse 34 and it says, well, they didn't really fear the Lord. So from their perspective, they were fearing the Lord and these other gods. From God's perspective, if it's God and something else, you're not doing it right. That's the balance here. That's the perspective. So verses 36 through 38, you have just again a review of God saying, I've given you statutes, commandments, laws, judgments, ordinances, sacrifices, and you haven't done them. Verse 40, howbeit they did not hearken, but they did after the former manner. So these nations feared the Lord and served graven images, both their children and their children's children, as did their fathers, so do they unto this day. That phrase, unto this day, means the time of the writing. At the time 2 Kings was being written here, this was still the common practice. So, this was Assyria. That was, in summary, their practice. They would deport, they would repopulate, and this did not enhance the worship of the God of heaven. This just further cemented idolatrous practices and so forth. That continued to be, you know, the general tenor of the northern kingdom as long as they existed before, you know, the total captivity there. So the idolatry continued, but God said, you're not going to get away with it to his children. You know better. I've warned you over and over and over and over and over again. This is your punishment. What we're going to see in chapter 18 as we move there with King Hezekiah is there were still a few after this point who were willing to humble themselves. As we move into Hezekiah and Hezekiah begins to try to restore the worship of the Lord, there were a few that humbled themselves. Why do I point that out at this juncture? Because it would be pretty easy to say, you know, as we kind of made an application last week, you know, America has certainly forgotten God in the public sphere and served self and other areas. It would be easy to say, well, you know, America's done. But that does not mean that we should give up on the people that live here any more so than we should say, well, we shouldn't send the Duartes to Brazil because, you know, they're not interested, or we shouldn't send, you know, the Maiettas to Italy because, after all, that's where the Vatican is and the Pope and all of that, and they're not interested in the teachings of the Bible. No, I mean, even though there was a majority that did follow idols and do all of these things, there were those that were willing to follow the Lord. And we must not lose sight of that, even if there is a, you know, lack of encouragement, shall we say, about the national direction or the national scene. So God's summary of the northern kingdom was, you disobeyed. I told you over and over and over and over and over again. I gave you the law of Moses. I gave you David. I gave you prophets. You made your choice. Now this is your punishment. And so now the focus for the rest of Kings and Chronicles is going to shift, you know, exclusively to the kings of Judah, because there are no more kings of Israel. Israel as a nation is functioning as a servant and not as an independent group. All right. So now that brings us to the man Hezekiah. That's a name that you're probably familiar with, at least by hearing it. Okay, you've heard the name Hezekiah before. 2 Kings chapters 18, 19, and 20 deal with major events from the time of Hezekiah, along with 2 Chronicles, four chapters. So three chapters in Kings, four chapters in Chronicles deal with Hezekiah. Now, if we were to back up a little bit in the study, who was Hezekiah's father? All right, his father was Ahaz. All right, now, Ahaz was the grandson of Uzziah. You remember that name, at least vaguely? So Uzziah is the great-grandfather to Hezekiah. So he definitely has a godly line here. You have Uzziah and Jotham, and they served the Lord. Ahaz, on the other hand, was an idolater who turned away from the path of his father and grandfather. Ahaz decided, I'm going the opposite way. He promoted the worship of idols and high places and all of that to the best of his ability. So Hezekiah had no parental godly influence, but he chose to be godly when he was old enough to make his own decision. He did not grow up and say, well, my father, you know, took me to church and made me do this and made me do that kind of thing. No, Hezekiah made his own individual choice. He chose the path of godliness as opposed to the path of the idols of his father. So he became king at age 23. Look here at chapter 18, verse 25, and I think it was 3 years into the reign. 18, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea, that's where my three came from, third year of Hoshea, which is Israel, Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. 25 years old was he when he began to reign. He reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that David his father did. Verse 4, he removed the high places, break the images, cut down the groves, break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and he called it Nehushtan. He trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor any that were before him. Now, this is kind of a summary, but as far as the timeline goes, The earliest events are detailed in the Chronicles account. So if you can hold a bookmark here if you like. But let's turn over to 2 Chronicles 29, if you would, please. 2 Chronicles 29. Hezekiah began to reign, verse 1, when he was 5 and 20 years old. He reigned 9 and 20 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abijah, the daughter of Zechariah. He did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that David his father has done. Verse 3. He, in the first year of his reign, in the first month, opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. So, first thing he did was to reopen the house of the Lord. Why had it been closed up? Why was it closed up? Because his father Ahaz said, I'm going with the idols in the high places. And he shut it up. I mean, previously the bronze altar had been removed and placed in a place of idolatrous worship and so forth. And so, the first thing he did, first year, first month, was he began to reopen the house of the Lord. Notice in verse number 4, he brought in the priests and the Levites and gathered them together into the east street. Now, while his father was king and the high places were the predominant place of worship, what was the situation of the priests and Levites? Were they full-time employed at the temple? No, there's no services. There's no offerings being brought there. There's no structure there. So what did they have to do? They had to go find another job to feed their family, right? And that had been going on for a while. His father Ahaz ruled for, 16 years, I think it was, something like that. So, I mean, that had been going on for a long time. The house of the Lord's been closed for at least 10 years, maybe more. And so it's there, the building and the structure's there. The law of Moses still exists, but it's been completely ignored. So now he's trying to get things restarted. So you see here his charge or his instructions to the Levites. Verse 4, he gathered them together. Verse 5, he said unto them, hear me, ye Levites, sanctify now yourselves and sanctify the house of the Lord God of your fathers and carry forth the filthiness out of this holy place. Our fathers have trespassed and done that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord our God, and have forsaken him, and have turned away their faces from the habitation of the Lord, and turned their backs. Also they have shut up the doors of the porch, and put out the lamps, and have not burned incense, nor offered burnt offerings in the holy place unto the God of Israel. Wherefore the wrath of the Lord was upon Judah and Jerusalem, and he delivered them to trouble, to astonishment, to hissing, as you see with your eyes. Now if you can remember, 2 or 3 weeks ago, we talked about the fact that when the Assyrians came, they captured parts of Judah, some of the cities, and they besieged Jerusalem, but they were not able to overcome it at that time. But they had suffered at the hands of the Assyrians. Here Hezekiah is very honest and said, God was judging us for the sins of choice that we had made. Okay, so very interesting in verse 5, what was the order of sanctification? What was to be sanctified first? Not the building. Yeah. Verse 5, sanctify yourselves and then sanctify the house of the Lord. Okay? We can't clean up the house of the Lord until we're clean in the eyes of the Lord. Okay, that's the first step, is for me to deal with me before I deal with other things. Same thing for all of us. We must individually be right before the Lord, and then we can help to make sure things are right in the house of the Lord. But it said, sanctify the house of the Lord. The word sanctify means to cleanse or to set apart. I mean, both aspects of those are understandable. But I think, when we talk about sanctify as something that's set apart for a special purpose, I think a good illustration of that is for any of you, it's changed. The practice has changed, but if some of you may still have it, and if not, you probably still remember when mom or grandma had, the nice china set or the nice dishes, and they come out for Easter dinner or Thanksgiving or Christmas or, special occasions like that. And in some cases, there's an entirely separate cabinet to display that stuff, right? Why is that stuff there? Well, that's our special dishes. When do we use it? Well, we don't. We just look at it. But they're there if we wanted to use it. That's not the way mom or grandma says it, but that's what they really mean, right? But they're set apart for a special purpose. They're cleaned and they're cared for and they're set aside. They're not just used for common use. So that would be the idea of being set apart for a purpose. Okay, but that sanctify also has the idea of being cleansed, being clean in the eyes of the Lord. They're cleaned and then they're set aside. Just like you hope they do with those little tools they stick in your mouth at the dentist office, right? After they get done with you, those things are supposed to go into a machine and be sanitized and cleaned and taken care of. And you hope after that, you know, they plastic wrap it and set it aside so that it's kept clean until they pull it out and stick it in your mouth, right? Just try not to think about that the next time you go to the dentist. How many mouths has this pick been in this week? Now they're scraping on my teeth, you know. You want it to be sanctified, right? You want it to be cleansed and then set aside for a specific purpose. Well, they were to cleanse themselves and then cleanse the house of the Lord. Verse 9, lo, our fathers have fallen by the sword, and our sons and our daughters and our wives are in captivity for this. Now it is in mine heart to make a covenant with the Lord God of Israel, that his fierce wrath may turn away from us. Verse 11, I love this verse. I have it underlined, and I think there's an application for you and me. My sons, be not now negligent, for the Lord hath chosen you to stand before him, to serve him, and that you should minister unto him and burn incense. The opportunity to serve the Lord is not to be a point of, you know, bragging or pride or something like that, but rather it should be a point of diligence, a point of care, a point of effort. God chose you, therefore do not be negligent. The opposite of that would be to give care, to be diligent, to pay close attention. For the Lord had chosen you to stand before him. All right, so you have the charge to the Levites, and then in the following verses, you have the cleansing of the temple. Verse 12, the Levites arose, and you have a bunch of names here, and we'll drop down to verse 15. They gathered their brethren and sanctified themselves and came according to the commandment of the king by the words of the Lord to cleanse the house of the Lord. And the priests went into the inner part of the house of the Lord to cleanse it and brought out all the uncleanness that they found in the temple of the Lord into the court of the house of the Lord, and the Levites took it to carry it out abroad into the brook Kidron. Now, you probably heard that name before, right? The brook Kidron. I mean, that's mentioned in the Gospels, being near Jerusalem and so forth. But they're carrying it out. Do you think they just closed the doors, put a padlock on it, or whatever they did, and that was it? Or do you think that there was more to it in shutting down? I think those that were idolatrous and zealous about that would have gone further to defile the house of the Lord if they could. I mean, you see instances of that. You ever been in a house where somebody was getting evicted and they decided to make a mess out of it on the way out? You know, so they do that out of spite, out of anger, whatever. But it may not be done out of spite in that sense of being evicted. Very often it would have been like, you know, just like we would look at it as a positive if Hezekiah defiled the altars of Baal or the altars of, you know, whatever these false gods are. But there was all kinds of filth associated with idolatrous worship, as well as, I mean, if it's been shut up for 10 years, let's say, the dust and the dirt and, you know, whatever else. So the priests were the ones who were authorized to go inside the temple, and they maintained that protocol. The priests went inside and brought it outside, and then the Levites carried it on out to the dump, if I could say it in modern day terms, and they worked together. Now, if you have all these names in verse 15, it says they gathered their brethren. They had a pretty decent sized work crew, right? So how long you think it's going to take? Well, longer than I would have expected, maybe. Verse 17, they began on the first day of the first month to sanctify, and on the eighth day of the month that came they to the porch of the Lord. So they sanctified the house of the Lord in 8 days. So this kind of a work crew, it took them 8 full days to clean it out and get it to the point where it needed to be. You know, ladies, you know what it's like to... and try to get things cleaned up. Men, you know what it's like to ignore it in the shop or the garage. I mean, to clean things up. But, you know, it's one thing if it's, man, it took me all day to get this place back in order. But you get a work crew like this, and it took them 8 full days. This was a mess. This was an absolute mess. And it took them 8 more days to get the outside. Verse 17, middle of the verse, they sanctified the house of the Lord in 8 days. And in the 16th day of the first month, they made an end. So it took them 8 days to work from the inside out as far as the porch. But then they had the courtyard. And if you remember way back when, on the outside of the temple, there were kind of chambers, small apartments, bedrooms basically that were there. There around the courtyard, there were storage areas where they would keep the sacrifices and offerings that the people had brought, the tithes of the wheat and the corn and all that kind of stuff. So once you got out to the porch, there was still an entire outdoor area to be cleansed to get the entire courtyard and everything back into proper order. So 16 days it took them to clean out not only just the dirt and grime, but the idolatrous defilement, the unapproved or the unclean things that had been brought into the house of the Lord. Verse 18, then went they to Hezekiah the king and said, we have cleansed all the house of the Lord and the altar of burnt offering with all the vessels thereof and the showbread with all the vessels thereof. Moreover, all the vessels which King Ahaz in his reign did cast away in his transgression have we prepared and sanctified, and behold, they are before the altar of the Lord. That's a lot of work. But don't you think that was fun to finally bring that report to the king? Hey, we got it. We got it cleaned up. We got everything ready to go. We've got all the vessels sanctified. We've got all the furniture ready to go. We're ready. Do you think there was an air of anticipation with the people that wanted to serve the Lord? I do. I think that the word of this is starting to spread, and those that love the Lord, they're starting to get excited about this. Man, how long is it going to take? You think it'll be this week? Think it'll be next week? You know, kind of like when you have a building project at the church, and you know, you think it'll be this month? You think it'll be next month? Do you think it'll be anytime in the next 5 years? You know, when is it going to be done? But there's some anticipation building. Verse 20. So you have the cleansing of the temple, and then you have a sacrifice restored. How long's it been? I mean, we look at this and go, yeah, that's what they were supposed to do. How long's it been since they sacrificed to the Lord the way it was supposed to be done? Years and years and years. Verse 20, then Hezekiah the king rose early, gathered the rulers of the city, and went up to the house of the Lord. And they brought 7 bullocks, 7 rams, 7 lambs, 7 he-goats for a sin offering for the kingdom and the sanctuary and for Judah. That was just for a sin offering. It wasn't for anything else. Now, I hope you don't just read that and go, okay, 7, 7, 7, 7, okay, next. Do you ever stop and think about that? 7 bullocks, what is that? 7 cows. Yeah, full grown. This is not a small calf. I mean, 7 full-grown cows. That's a lot of meat to offer as a sacrifice. I mean, it's a lot of weight to deal with once you kill that thing and have to, you know, get the carcass up on the altar. How long did it take for that to burn? What kind of fire did you have to have, and how long did it take for that to burn? Okay, well, then we're going to do the same thing with 7 full-grown sheep, 7 lambs, small sheep, and then 7 full-grown goats. Say, well, you know, doesn't that seem a little bit excessive? Maybe that was just kind of their understanding of how grossly they had offended God, right? This is what they brought for a sin offering. Here I got 28 animals that are going to be offered as a sin offering sacrifice. So the king brought all of these sacrifices. And we tend to think, okay, yeah, he did it. He brought it. Next. I mean, think about it this way, ladies. It's about like saying, yeah, I fixed Thanksgiving dinner and we ate. I mean, we can make that statement, but how long did that process take? I mean, that started, you know, 3-4 weeks out when you start planning the menu and you start accumulating things, and then, you know, for 3 days you're, you know, getting things in order or making things ahead that can be made ahead and that kind of thing. I mean, they offered the sacrifices, but they had to be killed appropriately. The when an individual would bring a sin offering, they would place their hands on the head of that animal and they would confess their sin. And then the one bringing the offering would slit their throat. The priest would catch the blood. Then the blood would be sprinkled, and then the appropriate parts of the animal would be offered and such. But, I mean, just to do that, just to kill the animals and catch the blood, was not a 30-second process. Well, then to process the rest of the carcass once the blood's been offered and so forth. And then to place that on the altar and to have it burn. I mean, this was a solemn, it was an exciting time. It was a serious and solemn time. But this wasn't a, you know, a microwave event. This would have taken, you know, a fair amount of time. So they offered this sin offering on behalf of Judah and the kingdom and so forth. Verse 22. So they killed the bullocks, and the priests received the blood and sprinkled it on the altar. Likewise, when they killed the rams, they sprinkled the blood on the altar. Same thing with the lambs. Same thing with the goats. Verse 23, they brought forth the goats for the sin offering before the king and the congregation. They laid their hands upon them. And that was the symbolic part there. They would lay their hands on the head of that goat. And very often the one bringing the sacrifice would make confession. They were saying, I'm bringing my sin offering to the Lord because, you know, I stole Brother Jeremy's car. And I gave it to Jim Bray and told him it was a gift. You know, whatever it is, you know, they would confess their sin. But they put their hands on the head of the animal, and in a picture, the guilt was being transferred to the head of that animal. So now the animal is bearing that guilt, and the animal dies as a result of that sin. That's the picture with the sacrifice. So they brought the goats, and the king and the leadership, as representatives of the people, laid their hands on the goats. That was the symbolic part of it. And verse 24, the priests killed them, and they made reconciliation with their blood upon the altar to make atonement for all Israel. For the king commanded that the burnt offering and sin offering should be made for all Israel. It's an exciting time. It's a serious time. But his father, Ahaz, decided to forsake all of this. Hezekiah, at whatever point, had made up his mind, I'm not doing that. I'm worshiping the Lord. And as soon as he had an opportunity to do something about it, the first month, he said, we're going to open up the house of the Lord. Sanctify yourselves, sanctify the house, let me know when everything's ready to go. We're going to worship the Lord again. And that's what they did. You see, in verse number 25, a public worship service. Verse 25, he set Levites in the house of the Lord with cymbals, psalteries, harps, according to the commandment of David and Gad the king's seer and Nathan the prophet. For so was the commandment of the Lord by his prophets. And the Levites stood with the instruments of David and the priests with the trumpets. Hezekiah commanded to offer the burnt offering on the altar. And when the burnt offering began, the song of the Lord began also with trumpets and the instruments ordained by David, king of Israel. And all the congregation worshiped. And the singers sang, and the trumpeters sounded, and all this continued until the burnt offering was finished. I hope you note the order here. What was the first sacrifice that was brought? The 28 animals that were brought, bullocks, rams, lambs, goats. What kind of offering was that? It's a sin offering. Okay, that was to be brought with in case of an offense against God. There's a sin offering and there's a trespass offering, and there's a lot of overlap between them. But the sin offering emphasized, I think, a little bit more the offense against God. The trespass offering emphasized, you know, an offense against your brother that needed to be made right, okay? But there was a sin offering. Then there was a burnt offering. The burnt offering was the offering that was offered entirely. None of it was reserved for the priest. In the other instances, the meat offering and the sin offering, the trespass offering, a portion of that was given to the priests. That was their remuneration. That was their livelihood. Now, with the burnt offering, the entire thing was put on the altar. The picture of the burnt offering was what? Anybody remember? Total consecration, total dedication to God. Okay? And there was to be a burnt offering morning and evening, but the burnt offering was only acceptable once the sin offering had been made. Okay? So once the sin offering has been made and accepted, then I can offer my service to God. But I can't offer myself as a dedicated servant to the Lord until the sin offering has been made and accepted. So that's the order here. You have the sin offering, then you have the burnt offering. The burnt offering, the blood was offered, and then the entire animal was offered and consumed on the altar. None of it was reserved for self, and that's a picture of consecration. Lord, it all belongs to you. None of it's being held back for me, for my own use, for my own benefit. So while this was going on, again, I alluded to this a little while ago, with the sin offering, there were designated portions that would be burned on the altar. But here, whether it was a sheep or whether it was a cow, you put that thing on the altar, even if you get a nice, hot, strong fire underneath, it's going to take a while to burn that carcass, right? So while that's going on, the Levites are playing with the instruments of David, the priests with the trumpets, and all of that. So you have the worship services going on. Don't you just know somebody was saying this? Man, I haven't heard that song in years. I haven't heard those trumpets, and I don't remember how long. Boy, hey, listen to that. We used to do this every day. This used to happen every day. You know, the ones that serve the Lord, they're telling their kids, they're telling their grandkids, hey, come here, pay attention to this, listen to this. And those that wanted to worship the Lord were excited. They had the instruments of David and the song of David. If we go back to, we didn't emphasize, we started after David because Pastor had done a fairly extensive series with David. But if you go back to 1 Chronicles chapter 16, you'll see along in there in 1 Chronicles 16 that David, 15, 16, along in there, David organized the music part of the worship service. The temple services had a music portion as well as a scripture portion, okay? And there were full-time musicians in the temple. There were those that were paid to be singers, and there were those that were paid to be what we would call instrumentalists, even though the Bible talks about singing on instruments of music, okay? But there were, full-time musicians. They were paid to practice and do a good job. And then they were part of the public worship services during the time of David and Solomon. Of course, after that time, it would slowly fall off. But it looks like the instruments had been largely preserved. David would have invested a lot of money into the... Any of you ever bought instruments? Whether it's buying a piano for your house or buying a horn or any sort of stringed instrument. You're going to get anything that's worth anything. That's an investment, right? And so David had invested the time and the money in providing all of these instruments. And they have... It seems like many of them have been cared for, preserved, maintained, whatever. But now, the public worship services are getting going again. So this would have been, for those that wanted to serve the Lord, this would have been an exciting time. This was the first month that Hezekiah was king. As soon as he was anointed and officially installed and recognized as the king, first month, he called in the Levites and said, get busy sanctifying yourselves, sanctify the house, and as soon as everything's ready and pleasing to the Lord, you let me know, and we're going to offer a sacrifice. Praise the Lord for the Hezekiahs, right? And he did this right on the heels of a time of idolatry, which means we can serve the Lord no matter what anybody else is doing, right? And the Lord can turn things around when it looks bleak. But here, he's restored the public worship services, and we're going to go on and see in the next chapter that the Passover, which has been unobserved for decades, he's getting ready to observe it again. So in the time of Hezekiah, he is restoring the worship of the Lord. That's kind of a breath of fresh air from what we've been looking at, right? Idolatry and children offered to idols and incense in high places and ignoring the prophets. Now we got, thank the Lord, a breath of fresh air, somebody else that wants to serve the Lord. So, all right, we've got to quit there for today. We'll pick up with Hezekiah again next week. Thank you, Lord.